Welcome to Leaked, a program about food issues and questions around the community. Join Barry as he chews up the facts and spills the beans on what's happening in the secret life of food.
Hi everyone, welcome to Leaked. I am Barry and how are you this week? I hope you guys have been keeping warm and dry. Parts of the North Island were slammed by a cold winter storm and many people lost electricity and roads were closed. I spoke to my parents last week and it was really windy down in Wellington. Dunedin was covered in snow and I am glad to be here in Auckland. So what did I do last week? Well, I went to an engagement party and it was really lovely to see the grooms-to-be and also like seeing how intimate and lovely like everyone was. So this week I'm going to talk about coffee and ethnic food, specifically Iranian cuisine. I invited my friend Hamida to discuss about an Iranian dish called the Fusanjun. So I think this week is really important because it was talking about the food prices. Last week, Statistics New Zealand released a food price index in June and food prices rose 0.2%. But in actual fact, it actually reduced compared to last year. The food price index measures the change in food prices faced by households over time. The food price index is used to report on the changing price of food and non-alcoholic beverages in New Zealand. In June, fruit and vegetables prices fell, but meat, poultry and fish prices and non-alcoholic beverages rose. Well, I assume the non-alcoholic beverages are Coke and also juices. Wow, an avocado was $4.52 in June compared to $3.38 in May. I think that's around a 33% increase, but avocado is actually cheaper compared to last year, which is $4.61. I think this is a bit crazy, but a block of butter was actually $5.05 in June compared to $4.80 in May and compared to $3.38 in June last year. On another topic of rising food prices, Kumara supply falls and the price remain high. This is kind of interesting. An article that was just released in stuff.co.nz said that Kumara farmers have hit their worst supply shortage to date and the growers are blaming millennials and the cold spring. According to Delta Produce, a company that oversees almost half of New Zealand's Kumara growers in Northland, said that it was the worst Kumara shortage in 19 years and farmers are struggling. From Delta Produce, farmers' crops are down 40% compared to last year. Fresh kumara could not be imported because it's grown in the soil that is considered to be a biosecurity in New Zealand. Delta Produce was selling kumaras to supermarkets for around $6 each. I'm assuming this is per kilo. And apparently, they report that supermarkets are selling them around $8 or $9. I actually went down to the supermarket yesterday to check out the prices and oh my, the prices were really expensive. $8.99 in City Countdown and also $10 down in New World. That's quite expensive because I remember it was around $6 before and now it's like reaching into $10 is pretty expensive. According to the manager of Delta Produce said that the diet trends such as the paleo diet, also known as the caveman diet, made kumara a fashionable food among millennials. Sweet potato or kumara is a vegetable that originate from the Americas. The plant does not tolerate frost and grows best in an average temperature of 24 degrees. So any sudden change in the weather is likely to affect the growth of this vegetable. Besides the kumara is a staple for a lot of people's diet, kumara is actually really rich in dietary fibers, beta-carotene, vitamin B5, and B6. I'm not too sure if it's really that fashionable because like I ate it before the paleo diet was actually like on the rise. So yeah, it could be just like people's preference and because it's much more sweeter than a normal potato, I guess. And a fascinating story last week. Twitter went crazy when Eater.com posted a video featuring a dish called mint on toast as a quintessential British comfort classic. There was an immediate backlash on social media with most of the British claiming that they've never heard of it. I don't know about you, but I kind of enjoy mint on toast. It's really nice, savory, and especially for this cold weather, it's like nothing better, isn't it? And then some of the comments said, never ever, ever in a month of Sundays has anyone in Britain eaten this mess? In another comment, the only Brit to have eaten this mess must have been a pisshead who came home to a fridge to exactly beef, mint and bread. I thought this was actually a very nice story because Nigella Lawson actually jumped on the bandwagon as well. She actually really liked this dish. However, she's like, definitely it's not British. So as it turns out, it's a New Zealand dish. New Zealand has claimed this ugly looking thing and quite frankly, it tastes amazing. So today we're going to talk about coffee and also like Iranian food. But when we talk about food, it is impossible to not talk about culture. Culture is a social behavior and social norms found in our societies. Cultural values are shared ideas about what is good, right, and desirable in a community. So these are sometimes represented as goals that members of the society are engaged to have. As a result, cultural values are represented differently and can sometimes have a different shared norms, symbols, and rituals that people practice. For example, in the past, Asians tend to be more having a collective mentality. In India, there is a caste system, and where in New Zealand, people are perceived to be more equal and have a fair go. So cultural values are also expressed in personal values as well. It is likely that cultural values can influence our preference, choices, and behaviors, not just towards food. In the world, people practice different social norms and sometimes it is very controversial. For example, the French eat foie gras, which is fatty goose liver, which is actually really tasty. Shark fin soup in China. I don't think I've ever tasted this because it's quite expensive. Eating insects and also eating hemp. I remember when I was down at Otago, I was living with a flat with 30 people. There was one kitchen and we had only 8 stoves. Sometimes and very often there was a queue for cooking and I noticed that there is a stereotype going on and it's kind of true as well. The Chinese from the south of the Yangtze River tended to cook rice. The Chinese from the northern part of China tended to cook noodles. And I remembered a Kiwi guy always just ate potatoes. And I had a few Samoan friends and they were so excited when their parents came down and brought a box of corned beef. Despite people physically being in Dunedin and living in the same place, I guess our cultural heritage was dictating of what we were eating and also our food choices. So today, many New Zealanders tend to eat food for pleasure rather than for survival. Behind every food we eat, there is always a story. Without knowing the story behind the food we eat, it is really hard to understand the culture, people, and region. So what is ethnic food? I actually went up and searched this online and then went and saw a journal article and they described it as ethnic foods are described as foods originating from a heritage of an ethnic group who used their knowledge to local ingredients of plants and animal sources. For example, my family is from Hong Kong and we tend to eat a lot of seafood and sometimes we do follow the British tradition, which is like having afternoon tea, having coffee and toast in the morning, and also having baked goods as well, such as like having the egg custard tarts in the afternoon. But the term is very ambiguous. In a broader sense, ethnic food could be defined as an ethnic group or country's cuisine that is culturally and socially accepted by consumers outside of the ethnic group. For example, we see a lot of Korean, Chinese, and Japanese food on Queen Street. All are considered ethnic food outside of their own countries. But have you ever thought of religion playing a part of your diet? In the most obvious one, which is Muslim religion, which all meat are halal, the traditional Buddhist cuisine forbid people eating meat. And my family is Taoist, so during Chinese New Year and also my birthday, we tend to not eat meat as well. Ethnic foods are important because it ties people to places and people to the same ideology. It seems weird, but in a small amount of time, you could see that there are different types of food arising in Auckland, like going down to Pearl Garden, you could have Yum Cha, and then, like there is like different kebab shops down Queen Street as well. So why is ethnic food important? Recently, many nations have experienced an era of industrialization after going through a long history of agriculture. During the agricultural age, the development of food were focused on maximizing food production and creating new ways to preserve food. Storerooms were built to keep food away from animals, but nevertheless, it's still spoiled because of microbes. Various methods of microbial growth were discovered in different countries. various methods to prevent microbial growth were discovered in different countries. But I'll give you a few examples. So the way how the Chinese tend to stop microbial growth, we tend to fry food. The Chinese tend to use oil to reduce the water content in food. Indians use spice to prevent microbial growth. And almost all cultures have some type of fermentation to preserve foods. For example, beer, cheese, and vegetables, such as kimchi, miso, and sauerkraut, are examples of fermented foods. The period of industrialization was concerned about efficiency, competition, and making things available. During this period, the food industry started to take off and mainly focus on the development of maximizing calories that we eat. The development of the Industrial Revolution have changed a lot. We have moved away from our land, and we tend to not really know how it's made and who makes it. Basically, this is an area where convenience food started, and you could still see it today. If you go down to the supermarket, there are a lot of convenience foods, such as two-minute noodles, canned foods. These were basically just like a convenience food in a different form. Foods are more convenient than ever. For example, if you walk down Queen Street, you could see food outlets everywhere. New Zealand is kind of like a strange position, though. Even though we say we are quite distant away from our farms, we always acknowledge them because, like, you could just see it in country calendar where it's just like farmers is always like put on display and also like telling us like what they've been doing in the news. Farmers or the weather is always like in top news when there's snow. So why is ethnic food is important? This is because it allows us to understand someone's heritage and culture. I think to really understand someone's culture, we really should start opening up our stomach to eat their food. So today, instead of talking about Chinese food, I'll talk about Iranian cuisine. Iranian cuisine is also known as Persian cuisine. The style of cooking and method is relatively similar to the neighboring regions such as Iraq and also Turkish cuisines. Typical Iranian dishes are a combination of rice with meat, normally lamb, chicken, and fish, served with vegetables and also nuts. One of the most appealing thing about the Persian cuisine, in my opinion, is their use of green herbs and also spices. Meals are frequently served along with fruits, such as plums, pomegranate, prunes, apricots, and raisins. One of the main characteristics of Persian cuisine is that they use quite a lot of saffron on the in their dishes. As we all know, saffron is one of the most priciest ingredient in the world. One of the world's most expensive spice by weight, sometimes more expensive than the price of gold. Saffron consists of this stigma being plucked from the flowers, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's so expensive, because you have to do it manually. You can't do it through a machine because it's really delicate. Apparently, to obtain 1 pound of the saffron requires a person to harvest around 50,000 flowers, the equivalent of a football field. Imagine plucking that, like, two or three stigmas per flower. Man, the history of saffron cultivation and usage reaches back 3,000 years ago. From the past three millennia, saffron is a key seasoning, fragrance, dye, and medicine in many cultures. The taste and flavor of saffron is very complicated because the flavor and aroma is very subtle. I personally think it's really bitter, but some people say it's really floral, and it tastes like honey, and it's... I think it's more pungent than bitter. I don't know. It's just like you have to taste it for yourself. But before learning food, I've always thought that people use saffron for the color rather than for the taste, because it gives a really intense brightness. It's not really orange, but it's a mixture between red and yellow. It's a very fluorescent yellow and sometimes a strong rouge. So this week, I asked my friend Hamida to teach me how to make Fosan Jun. She is a PhD student at AUT doing food science as well. Fosan Jun is one of the most delicious Persian dish, traditionally cooked with pomegranate and ground walnut. Fosan Jun is a very tasty because it's tangy, sweet, and the texture is amazing. We'll just listen and see how she teaches us about the Iranian dish Fosan Jun.
Persian dishes are very delicious and made from fresh ingredients. Using fresh ingredients in Persian cooking is the key. Khorish Fasanjun is served over saffron rice and is made using several different methods. That some make it with small meatballs, some with turkey, and I make it with chicken. The common ingredients used in all of these methods are walnut and pomegranate concentrate, which is a thick syrup that gets all the credit for the amazing tangy sweet flavor of this recipe. To make fasanjun, you need onion that is a golden brown fried, chicken drumstick or thigh, walnut halves, cold water, pomegranate concentrate, kosher salt, black pepper, and pomegranate seeds for garnish. That is optional. If you want to make it, you should pick through the walnuts for any shells and add it to a food processor and process until it turns to tan colored paste. With the food processor running, add 1/4 cup cold water through the feet. Continue processing until the paste becomes uniformly beige in color. Fry the sliced onions with 3 to 4 tablespoon vegetable oil in stock pot until golden brown and remove from the pot. Add chicken to the same stock pot and top it with the fried onion. Spoon the walnut paste evenly over the fried onion. Sprinkle with salt and pepper. The result, the pomegranate concentrate over all the ingredients. Bring to boil over medium heat. The pomegranate concentrate tends to stick and burn fairly quickly to avoid high heat. And reduce the heat to medium-low. Cover the pot and simmer for 15 minutes. Now reduce the heat to low and simmer covered for an additional 1 hour and 15 minutes or until the sauce is thickened and the chicken is fork tender and falls off the bone. Stir every 15 minutes or so to make sure the sauce doesn't stick to the pot. If at the end of this time period the sauce has not thickened enough, leave the pot uncovered for about 10 minutes on low heat for a thicker sauce. Transfer the fasanjun to a serving dish and sprinkle some pomegranate seeds on top as garnish. If you want your fasanjun sweeter, add about 2 tablespoons sugar to it when it is simmering. This very famous iconic Persian stew is considered a festive dish served for important occasions and an essential part of every Persian wedding menu. You can serve it over white Persian steamed rice or saffron rice.
So if you'd like a copy of the recipe, please search up Planet FM for details. There should be a link on my program's page and the recipe will be up there soon. Unlike Iranian cuisine, I think everyone can agree that New Zealand does have a strong coffee culture. Coming from Wellington, it is really hard not to talk about coffee. Well, what makes New Zealand different compared to the rest of the world? New Zealand tend to be more fundamental and basic when it comes to our special brew. Instead of making pumpkin spice lattes or frappuccinos, which is taking the world by storm, we tend to prefer our humble flat white. The flat white is a coffee beverage with heated milk with minimal foam, unlike the cappuccino, which I think is actually the complete opposite because there's no foam at all. The milk is very velvet, very glossy and smooth. I remember this really well because I was a barista for 6 years. I remember this. I remembered as I pour the heated milk into the espresso shot, I tend to pour around the edges first and then cross over to the middle of the cup and then slowly draw it back. It sounds really simple, but everything is done in one motion and it's actually really hard if you want to make a pattern. Of course, like most foods, New Zealand, its origins are always contested. Both New Zealand and Australia are claims to the invention of the flat white. Here, I'm going to play you a song, A Cup of Coffee by Bob Marley. What is coffee? Coffee is a brewed drink made by roasted coffee beans, but these beans are actually not beans. Actually, they are cherries from a kaffir tree. The cherries are hand-picked and then the seed is separated from the fruit. There are different methods, but when you see it in real life, the beans are actually green. So it's actually brown when you start roasting it, but in real life it's actually green. But not all coffee beans are created equal. There are two main species of coffee. The most common one that we all know is Arabica, and the second one is Robusta. Around 70% of the coffee produced are Arabica, and 30% of the coffee are Robusta. Robusta packs 50% more caffeine than the other one, but it's really sharp and bitter taste. Arabica coffee is more desirable of the two because it has a more smooth texture and it's a bit more fragrant. I've always wondered, can you grow coffee in your backyard? No, the answer is definitely no, because New Zealand is cold for this plant. Coffee tree is a tropical evergreen shrub, and it grows between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, sometimes known as the coffee belt. Despite coffee being grown in many countries now, coffee can be traced back to the Ethiopian plateau. Most popular story of the discovery of coffee centers around a young shepherd and his goat. Legend has it that coffee started when a goat herder noticed that his goat was a bit energetic after eating a few berries from a certain tree. He noticed his goat was really strange and restless. The goat herder reported this to a local monastery. Monks from a nearby monastery heard about this phenomenon, and after trialing different methods like trying to make the cup of coffee, such as roasting, grinding, and infusing with water, and the drink was finally made. This beverage was amazing because it kept the monks going for long hours during pray. As the news moved east and coffee finally reached to the Arabian Peninsula, this is when coffee started to spread around the world. Coffee cultivation and trade began in the Arabian Peninsula in places such as Yemen, Persia, so the modern-day Iran, Syria, and also Turkey. Coffee was first introduced to Europe on the mainland of Malta in the 16th century via slaves. By the 17th century, coffee finally made its way to mainland Europe and was becoming very popular. However, some people reacted to this unusual dark beverage with suspicion and fear. If you've drunk coffee, you would know that the taste is quite bitter. I mean, like, we are not engineered to taste bitter food, so I would definitely be suspicious as well if I was them. But after a while, they finally accepted that about its amazing properties of keeping being energized and also basically keeping them awake. Coffee houses were established and quickly became popular because it became a center of social activities and communication in major cities in England, Austria, France, Germany, and Holland. In England, the term penny university sprang up because of the price of a penny allows the individual to engage in stimulating conversations. Back then, water was definitely not safe, so the drink for breakfast was beer and wine, and throughout the day, people were a bit too drunk. So those who drank coffee instead of beer were more alert and energized. The quality of work was greatly improved, and I think this is partly why the Industrial Revolution happened. So before I continue with this topic about coffee, I'm going to play you a clip from CBS, presented by John Leapock and also Anthony Mason.
A lot of folks in our newsroom perked up when they heard about two new studies linking coffee to a longer life. Grounds to call in Dr. John Leapock. John, what these studies tell us about coffee?
Anthony, research has suggested coffee may protect people from problems like diabetes and liver disease and might even lead to longer life. These were two large studies, one in Europe and one in the United States. Compared with drinking no coffee, people drinking one cup daily had a 12% lower risk of dying. Those drinking 2 to 3 cups had an 18% lower risk of dying over those 16 years.
Significant difference, John. Why do we think that is?
Well, it's interesting. You know, coffee has a lot of biologically active compounds like polyphenols and other things that may be able to lower inflammation and actually improve the way your body processes insulin. And it was interesting that in this study there was a protective effect that extended to people drinking both regular and decaf.
We often get reports like this that tell us something is good for us and a little later maybe not so good. Is this going to be contradicted down the road, do you think?
I can't say it won't be, Anthony, because that tends to happen to us. But these studies are very hard to do. You know, you're trying to account for a lot of different variables. For example, people who drink more coffee tend to smoke more cigarettes. Yeah. So you have to correct for that. And, of course, there are side effects of caffeine like acid reflux. You can have heartburn. You can have palpitations. Mm-hmm. But the editorial said something interesting. Although it's premature to say, let's prescribe coffee for its health benefits, it's at least nice to know there's increasing evidence that moderate coffee consumption can have a role, can be part of a healthy diet. And I can tell you, as a doctor, it's nice to be able to say, instead of don't eat that, don't eat this, to be able to just say, enjoy.
Yeah, good news. Thank you, John.
Two studies, one in Europe and one in the US, found that even having a cup of coffee actually reduces the risk of dying earlier from any cause and dramatically cuts the chance of death from digestive problems. People who drink one cup of coffee a day can reduce their risk of dying early by 12% over 16 years, while 3 cups of coffee can cut the risk of 18%. Authors from the research said coffee contains a lot of antioxidants and compounds that combat insulin resistance, lower inflammation, and improves liver function. So today I talked about food culture. Cultural values are shared ideas about what is good, right, and desirable in a community. It is likely that cultural values can influence our preference, choices, and behaviors towards food. I invited my friend Hamida to teach us how to make Fusan Jun. And for people that missed out, it is a beautiful Iranian stew dish made of ground walnut, pomegranate, and chicken. Coffee may not be as bad as we seem after all, because there was a news article claiming that apparently it reduces death, the chances of death in an 18-year period. I would like to thank Hamida for her recipe and appearing on my show, and I am Barry. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Leaked, a program about food news around the community. If you missed this program or want to hear it again, check out planetaudio.org.nz/leaked. That's L-E-E-K-E-D.
The Community Connection. planetaudio.org.nz.
For the latest scoop in fly fishing New Zealand, listen to Hooked on Fly Fishing on Friday nights at 6pm. We talk to fishing experts about where the trout are, what they're eating, and how to hook them. You can get up-to-the-minute river and lake conditions before you fish the weekend. Hooked on Fly Fishing, Friday nights at 6pm or on the internet at planetaudio.org.nz/hookedonflyfishing.
Archdiocese of New Zealand of the Ecumenical Patriarchate presents In the Narthex with Father Paul Patitsis. Join him as he shares with us the ancient apostolic faith of the Christian Greek Orthodox Church. Friday afternoons from 3:15 or anytime online. planetaudio.org.nz/inthenarthex.
Out in the cold? It's okay. You're always welcome at Planet FM's Facebook page. There's lots of information to connect you with all your friends and favorite programs. Just Google Planet FM.